You love the what? The fact that it never stops? How deep it goes? And that you've never heard this before? That it's the same thing you've always believed? You love Red Fisk Raw because you love remembering that the story has always been so much bigger than you. So make sure it sticks around. Join the Patreon support team for as little as $1.25 per episode, or guarantee I know your avatar by bringing the real guns. Either way, hear more of what you love every week. Support Red Fisk Raw. Now, we've already talked a little bit about the throne of God. Revelation chapter 4, right after John writes the letters that Jesus sends to the seven churches. He looks and there is this door in heaven. He's yanked by his hair up through that door, and behold, there's a throne. And this throne, if you remember, is a mirror, a reflection of two other images from the Old Testament. The throne that Isaiah sees when he's yanked up to heaven, and the throne that Ezekiel sees when heaven sort of comes down to him. In either case, it shouldn't come as a complete surprise to us to learn that God has a throne. So that in Revelation chapter 7, when John is being informed who these are, who stand with white robes washed in the blood of the Lamb and palm branches of victory over the purification of all things in their hands, when John is being told that these are they who have come out of the great tribulation, out of the era of the four horsemen of the curse, out of the fall into sin and the tyranny of the devil, that the song which describes them, which is sung next in verses 15 through 17, the heart, the core, I would say, of this great song of Revelation that we spent some time on as a whole a while ago, it shouldn't surprise us that this song starts by mentioning God's throne, before which we remember that the saints who are under the altar awaiting heaven, awaiting paradise, awaiting the resurrection, they're already there. And yet that's not going to go away. None of that should surprise us. But what might still surprise us is the idea that God has a throne at all. And this is odd. I mean, yes, sure, Jesus of Nazareth, the heir to David, he's got David's throne, but how did we get there? And what do we do then with David himself talking about God's throne as a separate thing from his own, at least back in Psalm 9, where he's giving thanks to the Lord with his whole heart, recounting all his wondrous deeds, how the Lord has maintained his cause? He says the Lord has sat on the throne, giving righteous judgment. The Lord sits enthroned forever, establishing his throne, David's throne, for justice. So this idea that God has a throne above and apart from David's throne, that is an interesting thing. I don't know that it's really as complicated as all that. In one sense, it's just a recognition of his authority, right? I mean, what is a throne but a place on which a king sits, and why? What is he doing? He's giving judgment. It's a symbol of his control, so that you're standing in the presence of the king as he sits on the throne with all of his power. But then you get a psalm like Psalm 11:4, in which David again speaks about the temple of God being the place of his throne. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. And you really get a glimmer there of that heaven on earth reality that the Ark of the Covenant and the temple is and are, that there is a fusion of two realms taking place in God's dwelling with his people in Jerusalem, like heaven is on earth at this point, literally. And you get this in Psalm 80 and Psalm 91, where it talks about how God is enthroned upon the cherubim, right? And we've talked about the cherubim and or the seraphim, these living creatures that are a representative of all creation in God's presence, singing holy, holy, holy and all that, right? But there are also statues that were on the seat or the lid of the Ark of the Covenant, where God's presence would dwell as he gave judgments to Moses, as he said that he would do back in the Torah, back in the old Levitical codes and Deuteronomic covenant. That is where God sits enthroned, both heaven and earth, all kind of rolled into one. Psalm 99, again, you know, the Lord reigns. He sits enthroned upon the cherubim. The Lord is great in Zion, right? In that Jerusalem place. This theology, I mean, it's just all over the Psalms. You can't even really mention it all. The Lord sits enthroned over the flood. And remember, what is a flood? What is the sea? It's the chaos of sin and destruction that God has made pure as glass, that he has quieted the sea monster, that ancient enemy that dwells in the depths of wickedness. The Lord sits enthroned over that. Now it's under his feet, right? As a sea of glass. The Lord sits enthroned as king forever. From where he sits enthroned, Psalm 33, he looks out on all the inhabitants of the earth. So his throne is such that he can see all things at once. Sort of like that one moment in The Lord of the Rings when Aragorn sits upon this throne, really, an old stone chair that belonged to his fathers of old, and he kind of looks out over the land that used to be part of Gondor, used to be under Gondor's control, and because of his bloodline, because of his right authority, he's able to see far off into the distance, beyond all human capacity. I mean, that is, and I use this word intentionally, that is just an inkling. Get it? That is just an inkling of what's really going on with the throne of God. And that the promise of Revelation chapter 7 is that in Jesus, with his blood, your new clothing, with his body, the body that you will be raised with on the day of resurrection, and yet, you know, fused with your current body, so you're still going to be you. The first bit of that paradisical reality is that you're going to be right before this throne of God, which is so much more than just pure authority, because in the lineage of David, under that covenant that God swore to David and David's son, now there'll be a man on the throne who you can see face to face, who you can talk with, who will call you by name, who will be your human liege lord. And this is where the two thrones become one, right? Because there is this throne of David. And as it says many places in Scripture, one example, Psalm 89, God says to David, "You have said, I have made a covenant with my chosen one. I have sworn to David, my servant, I will establish your offspring forever and build your throne for all generations." And this is just such a cool story in its own right. It's not really the main point today, but I'll try to make it quick, right? That once David has finally been freed from Saul and has come into the inheritance of his kingdom, and he's built himself a little bit of a palace, he's like, yeah, doing pretty well. God has given me good stuff. He's like, you know, I feel kind of bad about this because I got this sweet cedar palace and the Ark of the Covenant, God in my midst, the real throne from which I know the power of my throne comes. Well, he's in a tent. It's a nice tent. It's the tent he told us to put him in. But still, I mean, it's a tent. And so, you know, I kind of want to do a little more for him. I'd like to build God a house. And initially, the prophet Nathan's like, well, what you say is pretty good there, David. I think that's a great idea. Why don't you do it? But that night, you know, God's like, hey, Nathan. And he's like, what? And Nathan, you know, no. You go tell my servant David this. Say this is what I got to say. You're going to build me a house? Are you kidding me? Really? You are going to build me? I have never lived in a house. I have no desire to live in a house. I could have made one if I wanted to. And all the places where I've gone, did I ever say to any of the judges of Israel or any of those who shepherd him, why have you not made me a house of cedar? This is not good. I need a house of cedar for me. So, thus says me, the Lord of hosts, David, you were a shepherd, a boy, and I made you prince over my people. And I have gone before you to cut off your enemies everywhere. I've made your name great. You are known among the kings of the earth now, and you will be forever. Your name and the knowledge of your kingdom by itself is already not going to pass away. But I'll tell you something more. You're going to make me a house? I'm going to make you a house. And I'm not talking about that cedar over there. I'm saying that when you die, I'm going to raise up from your body a seed. And his kingdom will be a house for my name, a throne that will be established forever. My steadfast love will never depart from him, ever, ever, ever. Now Solomon comes along and he fulfills this. He builds the temple as God asks him to, and he has this pretty glorious throne. And even in his folly, the wisest man to ever, marrying a bunch of pagan wives and worshiping their gods, in his folly, God doesn't wrest the kingdom away from him. He takes it from his son. But see, this is where Solomon really isn't the one God's speaking about here. God is speaking about the real son of David, Jesus of Nazareth, born out of that lineage so many, many years later. God with us, a house that will never, ever pass away, whose throne, David's throne, and God's eternal throne now fuse into one, even as his natures, God and man, well, they incarnate. They dwell. Mystery of mysteries, beyond all thought and fantasy. But now this is where it's going to get fun. Because, right, so the elder says, these, with the blood of the Lamb on their clothes, they are before the throne of God. And we all remember that part, right? But what does he say next? You remember that he wipes away tears from your eyes, right? But that's not next. You remember that you're not going to hunger or thirst anymore. But that's not next. The next part is that you are to serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will shelter them with his presence. Now, that doesn't sound bad. I'm not saying it sounds bad. I'm saying it sounds plain. I'm saying it doesn't have this ring, this depth that makes you go, oh yeah, day and night, shelter. But no, it just kind of flies by, right? And the reason for that is because you do not know about the sons of Korah. I love these guys, the sons of Korah. And again, like so much of this, I am learning as I go. I have a handle on things in Revelation, but I don't know at all. And that's why I love doing this. I'm digging. So I knew kind of about these guys, but this connection and the depth of the theology of the sons of Korah, it's just huge. It takes us all the way through the Old Testament. The entire Old Testament is flushed with the sons of Korah. I mean, did you know that? Yeah, it's all right. It's all right if you didn't. I didn't either. But I love these guys. Because you can't really understand what it means to be before the throne of God if you don't know who these guys are. And I promise you, by the end of this, there's going to be one verse that you do know that you've heard said many times before and you've always thought it was pretty. And now, it's just going to go to a whole nother level. So all of this starts really with what you probably do know if you went to a good Sunday school. Now, Sunday school is a mixed bag and, you never really know. But if you went to a good one where they really taught you the Old Testament stories, then you have heard of Korah's rebellion. Numbers chapter 16. But what you might not have picked up on is who this guy Korah was in the first place. And to get that, you got to go back to Exodus chapter 6. And I told you, it's from the very start of the Bible here. Exodus chapter 6. And this is where you are given something that, again, we read over this too fast because it is kind of dry. I get it. It's a genealogy. You're given the lineage of Moses and Aaron. And to make it even more confusing, that's not really how the chapter starts. It starts giving you the lineage of other of the sons of Jacob, right? So you got Reuben's firstborn, and then you got Simeon's firstborn, and then you have Levi's firstborn. And then it just kind of sticks with Levi's family. And this has a lot to do with what's going to be happening in the book of Leviticus, right? Leviticus, in just another book in the Torah in just a moment, right? After the Exodus actually takes place, which it hasn't yet in the story, that it's going to come back to play on that reality. But first, here it just tells you in chapter 6, verse 16, that Levi lived to be 137 years old, good long life, And he just had three sons during that time, which is kind of interesting. Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And these guys matter. They kind of come back, but not as loudly. Kohath is the one who comes back more, because Kohath is where Moses and Aaron are going to come from. Not directly, though. So Kohath then has Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uzziel. And he lives 133 years down in Egypt. It mentions that Merari's sons are also considered Levites. I mean, I'm not quite sure what happens to Gershon. But then it goes on to follow Amram. He takes a wife who happens to be his father's sister, which isn't so cool. And guess what? She's the mother of Aaron and Moses. Yeah. And he lives 137 years. And you get a little bit more here. You got the sons of Izhar, the sons of Uzziel. And this could go by really fast if you don't remember this. Okay, so Amram is Izhar's brother. They're both sons of Kohath. Yeah? Amram marries Kohath's sister and gives birth to Moses and Aaron, but Izhar, Amram's brother, he has three sons. And they are Nepheg, Zikri, and out of order, Korah. Which makes this guy Korah Moses' cousin. And it tells us then that Aaron, he takes a wife, and he gives birth to Nadab, Abihu, and Eleazar, as well as Ithamar. And remember, a couple of these guys are the ones who offer unholy fire and end up getting burned by God later when they're made priests, and that doesn't go so well. That's interesting in and of itself. But then, verse 24, the sons of Korah, Asir, Elkanah, and Abiasaph, the clans of the Korahites. It's the first time it's mentioned clans in any of these names so far, and there's a reason for this. After it tells us who Eleazar, Aaron's son, takes as wife and who he bears, a guy named Phinehas, which is going to come back as well later, not today, but it applies later in the stories. It says that all of these names, every name you've heard I just mentioned there, are the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites by their clans. So they're all clans. They're all groups that have various positions of authority or role within the Levites themselves. And remember, the Levites are a family, a tribe set apart who gets no inheritance in the land because from them are taken the priests, and the rest of them are to help the priests minister or handle all of the sacramental, the covenantal things that the book of Leviticus, the book of Numbers, the book of Deuteronomy are going to put into place. Really, Leviticus puts into place. It's Exodus 2, I suppose. But yeah, you get the point, right? And remember, the Levites are not all priests. The priests only come from Aaron, right? Aaron is a Levite. Aaronites are priests. Not all Levites are Aaronites. There are these other clans. And while all the names mentioned here are said to be clans and heads of clans, the only one that by itself gets called out are the sons of Korah, the Korahites. Why is that? Now, Exodus goes on, and you get the Exodus story, right? They're brought out of the land of Egypt. They're brought to Mount Sinai. They're given the Ten Commandments. They're given the initial formation of the covenant, right? The book of the law with the blood all over it and blood on the people and water from the rock and all that stuff's going on, right? And then way down the line, in Numbers chapter 12, you have this moment where Miriam and Aaron decide to speak out against Moses. Which is interesting because Aaron's high priest. I mean, he's not leading the people, right? Not judging or prophesying for them now, but he's got a pretty decent position. And Miriam was also sort of helping to lead. She certainly is mentioned at various points as having a voice, right? She sings this amazing song at the Red Sea crossing. But they decide that this isn't, you know, they haven't gotten enough. Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses, they ask? Has he not also spoken through us? So that somehow they're getting a little bit of a head on their shoulders, yeah? And so God calls them all to the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, and the Lord comes down as a pillar of cloud, stands at the entrance, calls to Aaron and Miriam. They both come forward. He says, listen, if there is a prophet among you, I'm going to make that known in a vision. I will speak with him directly through his own dream. Not so with Moses. With him I speak mouth to mouth. Not in riddles. He beholds the form of the Lord, and you're not afraid to speak out against him? And the cloud goes away, and Miriam is a leper. Bam. And Aaron turns and sees her. Which, whoa, oh, holy moly. And Aaron's not a leper. Why? Because he's the high priest. Because he can't be a leper. God spares him, not for Aaron's sake, but for the sake of the covenant. But Aaron says to Moses, don't punish us. We're wrong. We're wrong. And Moses cries out, Lord, heal her, please. And God's like, what? If her father had punished her, it would have been 7 days before she was let off the hook. And yet, I, God, do it, and you guys want me to just back off right now? So she is. She's actually put outside the camp for 7 days, and then it said that she's brought in again, which means that her leprosy, I think it means her leprosy is gone. But you would think that everyone seeing this happen, they might have thought, God has a plan. God put us where we are. What God has given us is pretty good. Let's be happy with what God has given us. But no, the cousin of Moses, this guy Korah, the son of Issachar, son of Kohath, right? A Kohathite of the Levites, along with another dude, Dathan, and a guy named Abiram, sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, a bunch of Reubenites. They take some men, they rise up against Moses with a number of the people, 250 chiefs of the congregations. Huh? Well-known guys. I mean, these are the upstanding guys. These are the guys who are actually, they do well. They lead well. And they come up against Moses and Aaron this time. And they say, you guys are going too far. You are acting like you're special. You are acting like you have been set apart by God. You, Aaron, and your sons, the Aaronites, the priests, what makes you think you're more holy than us? Don't you know that all of the assembly of the Lord are holy? Every one of them, because God is with them. Now, don't miss how he's kind of right in that they are set apart. They are a nation of priests. They are a holy people. God has said this much already to them. But look what they do with it. They don't hear it as gospel. They see it as a right and a claim that they can make for power for themselves. And I know you've heard this today out in the church where people will speak against, say, the pastor. What, is he more holy than the rest of us? All of us have the same rights, right? Okay, well, you rights. Why are we talking about rights? Holiness is indeed a gift. But it's not one you can grasp with the hand. It is one that is given to you. And if the priest, in this case Aaron, is more holy, closer to God, because he stands next to the Ark of the Covenant and you don't get to, and if you go there, you die, what is that to you? It's not like holiness can be measured in quantity. If any holiness gets to you and you don't get burnt to a crisp, well, this is good. This is valuable. This is life eternal. If you sit at the right hand and the left hand of Jesus in his kingdom, you are going to be just as happy as if you sit far off in the fields growing avocados, which, by the way, is where I plan to be. And that's another story. Notice how this all begins. They want to make holiness their own. They want to grab it and own it and then use it. And Moses is like, oh, man. He falls on his face. He's like, look, guys, I've been through this before. This isn't going to go well for you. In the morning, we're going to let the Lord decide it. He does this. He's good at this. He's going to decide who is holy, who he wants to be close to him, and the one who he wants to be further out. So you guys go ahead and grab some censers, right? Take some censers, Korah and all your company here. Put fire in them to be used around the altar. And tomorrow, you can do that. And we'll let the Lord decide whether or not you're as holy as you think you are. But I warn you, sons of Levi, you have gone too far. And remember, the Levites are holier than everybody else. And you got to understand holiness this way, though, right? We think of holiness only in terms of like good works, sanctification, to become more holy, to do more good works. This is not the way the Bible talks about holiness. That's the way the Bible talks about righteousness, right? To become more righteous, to do more good. And there is, in that sense, there is definitely a progressive justification that takes place in the Christian life as you strive for the new obedience to do better. There is also a non-progressive, different righteousness justification that is strictly passive and totally a free gift. That's all real. But the holiness of the Old Testament is the holiness of proximity. It's the holiness of location, right? It's about being, again, like literally next to the box. So follow me on this one. When the pastor is holding up the bread and the wine for the Lord's Supper, And he says the words of institution which Jesus gave us to believe in. At that moment, he's more holy than you. Because at that moment, somehow, I don't know when it starts, right? The words do the work. We don't know when. We can't pinpoint it. But we know that it's happening at this time. The words of institution do the work. We know that much. At that moment, the pastor's more holy than you because he's holding Jesus in his hands as a piece of bread. He stands closer to Jesus than you do. Now, you're baptized into Christ, so there's a sense where you're equally as close. But don't be rude, right? Just follow the idea. You should be able to understand this. So far as the bread is concerned and the bread is holy, the pastor is more holy than you. Then you come up and you kneel down and the bread, which is the holy thing, comes out to make you holy, right? And as the pastor walks closer to you, you're getting more holy. And as the bread's going into your mouth and going down into your gullet, you're getting even more holy. Now holiness has fused with you. That's the kind of holiness that they're talking about here. And they're saying that the holiness we have received as Levites to be close to the tabernacle, to help with the tabernacle, that's not good enough for us. We want more than that. And Moses says, go ahead, try. Now, there's a little bit here in, you know, verses 12 to 14 where like some of them don't want to do it. They're like, no, we don't have to do this. What, are you going to kill us now? Is this a trap? So Moses sends word to Korah, look, make your company present because this is what you're claiming you want to be able to do. I'm telling you, go ahead, do it. Take a censer, put incense in it. All 250 of you leading men of Israel, go ahead and do it. And Aaron, he'll be there with you. So they all do this. They take their censers, they put the fire in, they lay incense on them, and they go to the tent of meeting. And the glory of the Lord appears before the congregation, right? The smoke and the fire, he all shows up there just like that. And he says to Moses and to Aaron, move back. I'm going to consume them. And they fall on their faces. God of the spirits, shall one man sin and you be angry with everybody? And the Lord says, say to the congregation, move back from Korah and Dathan and Abiram. So they rise and they say this. Everybody back away from the tents of these wicked men. Don't touch anything that belongs to them. Just get out. Otherwise, you're going to be brought down with their sin. So everybody that's there, they back away from Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And then it says, Dathan and Abiram came out. They stood at the doors of their tents with their wives and their sons and their little ones. And Moses says, this is how you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do these works. This is not me. When the ground itself opens up and swallows them whole, alive, down into Sheol, then you shall know that these men have despised the Lord. Bam! Ground splits open. The earth swallows them whole. Them and all their households, all the people who belong to Korah and all their goods. So they go down alive, buried alive, swallowed alive into Sheol, and they perish. And everybody who is there cries out as fire comes out from the Lord and consumes the other 250 men who were offering the unholy incense. I mean, it's just amazing. Moses then says to Aaron, you know, talk to your son Eleazar, tell him to go get all those censers, right? So that the men are dead and burned, but those censers that were holding the incense, they're lying on the ground. He says, go grab those. Hammer them into plates, put them on the altar, like build it around the altar, because now they're holy, right? God has touched them with his fire, and this will be a sign to the people for basically forever, right? To remind the people that no outsider who is not a descendant of Aaron should draw near to burn off incense before the Lord, lest it become like Korah and his company, right? To remind the people that without God's choice, there is no gaining of holiness. Now, if you were like me, you kind of pretty much thought, okay, well, that was the end of them. No more Korah. All his sons were with him. Well, no. No, it says the sons of the other two guys were there. It says the household and the people who joined with Korah. But would you believe it? His three sons, they backed away. They weren't part of the rebellion. In Numbers chapter 26, after the plague that the Lord sends upon the people because of worshiping the Baal of Peor, And remember, this is that whole Balaam thing. After this, there's a census taken, right? A lot of people have died, so they're taking a census of the 20 years old and upward by their father's houses, everyone who can go to war. And when talking about the Reubenites, it mentions the sons of Eliab, including Dathan and Abiram. These are the other two guys who joined with Korah to contend against Moses, who the earth opened his mouth and swallowed them along with Korah so that all of their company died, including the 250 men, and they became a warning. Except, verse 11 says, not in the list of the Levites, it's in the list of the Reubenites. I don't know why it's here, but here it is. Except that the sons of Korah did not die. So again, the sons of Korah, they did not join Korah's rebellion. And so later in the same chapter, when it does mention the Levites and all their clans, the Korahites are there. Now, after this, we don't really hear much more about them. At least, they're there, but they're kind of behind the scenes. And you got to go kind of forward to go back. So in 1 Chronicles, we learn, in the midst of another census of the Levites, we learn that when David is taking care of the tabernacle and bringing it into the center of the city of Jerusalem, he helps organize things a little bit. And he takes some of the skilled Levites that he finds, and he gives them certain jobs. So we're told in chapter 6, verse 31, "These are the men whom David put in charge of the service of song in the house of the Lord after the ark rested there. They ministered with song before the tabernacle of the tent of meeting until Solomon built the house for the Lord in Jerusalem, and they performed their service according to their order. These are the men who served and their sons of the Kohathites." And then it lists a really long line that seems just mind-numbingly boring, but stick with it. Heman is the first one, the singer. "Son of Joel, son of Samuel, son of Elkanah, son of Jehoram, son of Eliel, son of Toah, son of Zuf, son of Elkanah, son of Mattath, son of Amasi, son of Elkanah, son of Joel, son of Azariah, son of Zephaniah, son of Tahath," are you tired yet? Yeah. "Son of Asir, son of Ebiasaph, son of Korah, son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, son of Israel." So Heman, the Korahite, yeah? And his brother, Asaph, who stood on his right hand. And then lists his lineage, and he doesn't go back to Korah, but he goes back to Gershom. Levi has three sons, Gershon, Kohath, Merari. Kohath has four sons, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, Uzziel. You can forget the last two. Amram, father of Moses and Aaron, Izhar, father of Korah. So now we're pushing back one generation and you're looking at like second cousins once removed or something for the sons of Gershon. But then look, with Haman, the singer of the clan of Korah, appointed, to his right stands his ancient cousin from the clan of Gershon, and to his left, brothers, sons of the clan of Merari. That would be the other son of Levi. David's making sure everyone's kind of, you know, got a job by style. And yet in this, as they're all appointed for all of the services around the tabernacle of God, which, right, there's not the priestly service. There's like the taking care of it. You know, you got to manage the money. You got to make sure the cows get there, and you got to clean up the dung, and you got to do all this stuff, right? And it's not just there. It's throughout the whole land of Israel. The Levites have their portion in the cities, and then they come and they serve and all this kind of stuff. And for all of that, the sons of Korah are appointed by David to be in charge of the songs of the tabernacle. Now, we know that's not all they do. They have something else they have to do. Well, most of the Levites, through the next couple of chapters in 1 Chronicles, are given cities to dwell in, right? And then they come and they take their place and they help. The Korahites are kind of set apart. In chapter 9, verse 17, it says, "The gatekeepers were Shallum, Akub, Taman, Ahiman, and their kinsmen. Until then, they were in the king's gate on the east side as the gatekeepers of the camps of the Levites." Shallum, again, this is the first guy's name, the leader, the son of Kor, son of Ebiasaph, son of Korah, and his kinsmen in his father's house, the Korahites. They were in charge of the work of the service, keepers of the threshold of the tent, as their fathers had been in charge of the camp of the Lord, keepers of the entrance. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, this is the priest, right, was officer over them in times past. The Lord was with him. So the Korahites are the gatekeepers of the tabernacle. They're the ones who have to stand watch. They're actually guards. At the time of David, it was 212 of them that were chosen for this service. They were enrolled according to their clans by David and Samuel and established in this office as a trust, so that they and their sons were in charge of the gates of the house of the Lord, that is, the tent, as guards. Verse 24, the gatekeepers were on the four sides, east, west, north, and south. And their kinsmen who were in their villages were obligated to come in every 7 days in turn to be with them. These four chief gatekeepers, Shallum, Akkub, Talmon, and Ahiman, who were entrusted over the chambers and the treasures of the house of God. And they lodged around the house of God, for on them lay the duty of watching. And they had charge of opening it every morning. Some handled the utensils. Others were appointed over the furniture. Some deal with the flour, the wine, the oil. The firstborn of Shallum, a Korahite, was entrusted with making the flat cakes. I mean, when you get this, the Levites are supposed to help the priestly class in general. But these Korahites, I mean, they got, you could call it the best duty, but it's the slave duty. Are you following me? They're there day and night before the throne of God. And we'll come back to that. That's kind of the whole point. But while they're there, they sing. They write the songs. Now, why would David give this special call out to the sons of Korah? What have they done? Where have they been that would make them stand apart in this way? I mean, maybe, yeah, they're just really good at singing or at writing psalms or who knows what, but how would he know this? Well, that was great. This is where I said you got to go ahead to go backwards. Do you remember after Saul had gone crazy? I mean, he kind of, yeah, it happened a few times, right? But when he was pursuing David in the wilderness, basically traipsing everywhere, hunting David when he should have been fighting the borders where the Philistines were encroaching and others. And you got a couple things happening. You know, David spares his life twice, once in the cave, once in the camp. David like shouts to wake up the whole camp. He's like, hey, look, Saul, Abner, the guy who's supposed to have your back, the guy you trust so much, he wasn't even watching over you. I could have totally killed you just now. And Saul's like, is that you, David, my son? You know, he's so weird. David's like, yeah, it's me. Why are you chasing me? I love you as a son, like you just said, but you don't believe it, but I do. And Saul's like, I have sinned. Return, David. I won't harm you. I promise. And David's like, that's all right. That's all right. I'll stay over here. Here, you can get someone. Someone can come take your spear back. That's cool. Just remember, today your life was precious in my sight because the Lord has anointed you. And even though he's anointed me to come after you, I will not lift my hand against you. So I'm going to go that way now. Can you just kind of let me be? Is that cool? And so I was like, oh, David, God will bless you. I'm so despairing. God hates me. Which is kind of like, you know, I mean, he really is. He's trapped in his own depression. And I don't mean depression like as in just a mechanical thing or a chemical imbalance in the brain. I mean that he rejected God's word and then refused to believe in forgiveness ever again. And just kept going deeper and deeper into his own unbelief. And finally, God's like, yep, you're out, man. You're out. But David, right after this event, right? He's like, look, I know what this guy's going to do. He's going to go crazy. He's going to turn. He's going to attack me again. One of these days, he's going to catch me. So I'm going to go to the land of the Philistines. I mean, since the one thing Saul won't do is go fight them, I'll just go live among them, and then I can probably be safe over there. So David rises, and he flees with 600 men to Achish, son of Maach, the king of Gath. I mean, he takes everything. He takes his two wives, Ahinoam and Abigail. And on behalf of the king of Gath, David makes raids against other enemies, the Geshurites, the Gezerites, the Amalekites, and so forth, so that he finally is like, hey, king of Gath, what's up? Yeah, I'm doing good work for you, right? Right, you trust me now? Can you, like, give me some land? And I'll chill there. I'm totally going to serve you. I will not betray you. I promise this. And so he's given a place. He's given a land. It's called Ziklag. Now, what David didn't do was tell Achish that he never raided Judah, because he was kind of supposed to, right? So Achish would be like, hey, where'd you raid last? He's like, the Negeb of Judah, against the Kenites and stuff, right? And so he let him think that he was fighting Israel as well. Because you might be like, well, how did the king of Gath not know? Well, because he kept bringing back tribute from all these other groups he was raiding. There was no email, right? I mean, this is miles away. And he's not raiding the king's own stuff. He's raiding other people, Amalekites and whatnot, right? And when he did it, I mean, he would kill everybody. He would kill even the women and the children so that nobody could say, David has done this. And in this way, he was able to protect the borders of Israel, which Saul, the rightful king, wouldn't do. And Achish trusted David, thinking, you know, his people must hate him now. He will be with me forever. But then there's sort of a parade one day, and the king, Achish, he's showing off everything. And so David and his men are marching by, and one of the commanders of the Philistines says to him, isn't this guy David? You know, he's been with me for years now. Isn't he great? I mean, he used to be a Hebrew, but he doesn't care. He's happy to fight for me. He's come over to my side. He knows where the real power lies. And some of his other commanders are like, what? No. Send that guy back quickly. Don't let him go with us into any real battle. He'll turn on us in the middle of the battle. How could he possibly reconcile himself to his Lord after this? Would it be not with cutting off our heads? Don't they sing about this guy? Saul has struck his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. And so Achish, he calls David to him. Hey, look, as your God lives, you've been honest with me, which is not entirely true. And it seems to me right that you should come with me and fight. Where are they going to fight, by the way, in this parade? They're going to go fight Saul. It seems to me you should come and fight with us against your Lord. Not God, but against Saul. Nevertheless, these other lords, they don't approve of you. So just go on peaceably and everything should be good. And David's like, what have I done? What did I do? I mean, I've been for you this whole time. I've been smiting your enemies. What's the problem? And he's just like, no. I get it. You're blameless in my sight. But I got to fight with these other guys from these other cities that are also Philistine cities, right? It's not like all the cities. It's not like Philistia was one country. You have a bunch of city states and they're all along the water, right? And so Gath was one of these. So he's like, these other leaders, they're not so cool with you. And so it's not about me.
It's not me, David. It's not you, David. It's just the circumstances.
So David doesn't go to fight against Saul, but instead goes home. He goes back to Ziklag. And when he gets to Ziklag, he finds that it's been pillaged and his wives have been captured. There's a whole ordeal that goes on. He calls to Abiathar the priest. He gets basically a revelation from God, a prophecy. Should I pursue the band? Yes, pursue them. And he takes his 600 men that were with him from before. He takes them and he pursues. There's a bit with the Egyptian who has to show them their way there, but he catches up. He defeats the Amalekites. Nothing that is missing. He rescues everything. He gets all of the spoil back. He's back at Ziklag for 2 days, and on the third day, some guy comes up, and he's a guy who's a member of Saul's camp. His clothes torn, dirt on his head. He comes to David, he falls down, pays homage, and he says, basically, Saul and his son Jonathan are dead. Now, things don't go well for this guy. It's a different story. He is actually the one that killed Saul. But again, this is back at Ziklag, right? So it's all swirling around that Ziklag thing. I just like saying the word Ziklag. Ziklag. But no. No, really. We're asking the question, why does David have a place in his heart for the Korites? Well, 1 Chronicles 12 tells us about these 600 men who were with him when he could not move around because Saul had pursued him and he left and fled to the Philistines. Bowmen who could shoot arrows and sling stones with either hand. Their leader was a guy named Ahiezer, and then there was Joash, who comes back into the stories later as well. There's a bunch of them. Pelet, Jeziel, Baraku, Ishmaiah of Gibeon, who was a mighty man among the 30, and a leader over the 30. Listen. Belaliah, Shemariah, Shephatiah, Azarel, Joazar, Joshabim. Oh. And the Korites. The sons of Korah, or among the men who came to David at Ziklag while he could not move about freely because of Saul, the son of Kish. So that the entire time that David is raiding the Amalekites and the Girshites on behalf of Achish, the king of Gath, the sons of Korah are right there with him, mighty men fighting in battle, standing by his side. When he has to run after, chase after the Amalekites and save his wives. He has the 600 men with him, and there's some 200 that end up staying behind at one point. They get tired. Now, I don't know who it was, but I gotta believe it was not the sons of Korah. But they went all the way there with them, which means they were the ones who complained when they had to share the bounty, with those who didn't go and watched the bags instead. But they get a reward. Capable as they are of guarding, of defending, of fighting, they are made those who stand watch at the most holy place of all, at the tabernacle, eventually to be the temple, filled with all manner of wealth. I mean, whenever you see Jerusalem sacked, guess what gets plundered, right? It's the temple. That's where all the treasuries are. These are the guys who stand watch, who guard it. They are capable of doing so, and it would seem that they were capable of writing and collecting the Psalms so that we have a number of Psalms that are written by the sons of Korah. It says so in the inscription. We are also aware that the sons of Korah outlast the lineage of David. So that as David's house eventually declines and is swept away into the exile, the Korahites are those who are mentioned as coming back to live in the land after the exile. 1 Chronicles 9 tells us that the priests and the Levites were some of the first to come back. And of the Levites, those gatekeepers we had mentioned earlier, Shallum, Akub, Taman, and Ahiman, and the other sons of Korah who helped them. And it's likely that it's at that time, either in the exile or post-exile, that the Psalter, the book of the Psalms, is really put together. It's not that they didn't have the Psalms, that they wrote it all then. It's that they collected and categorized them and put them in an order. The Psalter itself really does have, as a whole, a flavor of hoping for a restoration, as if it really was put together while they were in Babylon. Now, I can't say that for sure. But what I can say for sure, I think, is that there are two Psalms that you got to know about that are written by the sons of Korah. One is Psalm 46. The psalm upon which Dr. Martin Luther based his famous hymn, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. He bases that on verse 11. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. And it opens up, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Verse 7, the Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Now, it's an awesome psalm because if they're writing this during the exile, they're writing it at a time when they're wondering what has happened to the covenant, right? Where everything has passed away. They have the promises of Isaiah and Jeremiah that they're going to be restored to the land. But man, does it look bad right now? It looks like God isn't with them. But they're going to say, nope, we're going to believe no matter what. God is our refuge and strength. The God of Jacob is with us. He is a fortress. Therefore, verse 2 says, we will not fear even though the earth gives way. Now, are you kidding me? The sons of Korah? The man who for his claim to holiness on his own count has the earth give way beneath him and is swallowed alive down to Sheol, his sons in exile say, even upon the great shame of our family, if it should come upon us again and take us, we will still confess, preach, and trust in the God of Israel and his covenant. Though the mountains be moved to the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, should a flood again destroy the earth, which it never will, because he said it won't, but even should it do so, God is in our midst, the midst of Jerusalem. She will not be moved. God is at the heart of the tabernacle and the temple. And though we're without it now, or maybe they've just come back from the exile, here it is. No ark in it, but nonetheless, temple wall restored under Nehemiah and Ezra. God is in our midst with these promises. They shall never pass away. And it is for this reason and this trust and this memory of their father who did not understand this that they also write Psalm 84, which I know you know part of it. How lovely is your dwelling place, O Lord of hosts. My life longs, yes, faints for the courts of the Lord. Blessed are those who dwell in your house, ever singing your praise. For a day in your courts is better than 1,000 elsewhere. Yes, I would rather be a gatekeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of the wicked. I would rather be day and night sleeping at the gate to this tent on behalf of the God who reigns there, who has made David king. I would rather be sleeping day and night before this temple and making the flatbread cakes and putting together the flour and pulling the cows in, even though there is no ark here to throw the blood on. I would rather do these things than be anywhere else. The tents of wickedness hold nothing to the house which God has made, well, for himself, to the house which God will make for David. So it is not a coincidence when John is told that all Christians, all believers of the Old and the New Covenant, the proper number of the church, uncountable, yet 144,000, when he is told that they are before the throne of God, that is, they're in the presence of holy God, that they serve him day and night in his temple, that they are the inheritors of the sons of Korah, whose forefather cursed mankind and pulled us down into Sheol alive, but who, well, because of the covenant, because of the promise, because of their trust in the Savior, who stepped back from his house, who let it go down, as it were, in the great and mighty roaring flood, but who stood aside and said, what is blood to me? I will stand until I'm appointed to the duty for which I am given. And then that duty was appointed, and it was to man the gate, man, guard the gate. Better to do that than dwell in tents of wickedness. Glad to do that. We'll sing praises of that. We'll write songs about how much we love it. We'll write songs about serving him day and night in his temple. He who sits on the throne, who will shelter them with his presence. And with just a few moments left here, I mean, that also, that sheltering is huge. It's a hat tip to Isaiah chapter 4. Now, Isaiah chapter 4 is really short, but it's not really a chapter. It shouldn't be taken by itself. It certainly has an edge to it. It's the foreshadowing of the branch, the shoot that's going to come up from the stump of Jesse, the sprout that Zechariah mentions. All that's here. It's like the first taste that we get of it. But it's on the back end of what amounts to be a much longer prophecy that runs from chapter 2 through chapter 4. So Isaiah opens, chapter 1 is like a prophecy that stands alone, it probably was prophesied later, like not right at the start of his career, but it stands as sort of the capstone or the introductory letter for the book, if you're going to understand the book. And then chapter 2 through 4 is like a summary prophecy. It kind of contains all the possible prophecies that are going to come as they're laid out in the book, right? So you got to think it was like edited, whether it's by Isaiah or otherwise, I would say it's by Isaiah, that he actually laid these out in order. He'd preach them all, and he's like, okay, but they make sense in this order for all time. Here we go. Boom, 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 boom. And then Isaiah 5 is the famous Song of the Vineyard, which is like a parable about everything that he's prophesied up to that point in these two other prophecies. And then Isaiah 6 is his vision where he is shown the Lord high and lifted up, and he's consecrated to be a prophet, right? So the chapter 2 through 4 prophecy is largely condemnation. I mean, it's just massive, massive language of condemnation that starts by condemning the entire world, but very quickly moves into condemning the people of Israel for being part of that world. And this is, you can't hear this just as the Jews or just as the nation state of Israel. You got to hear this as even we Christians, we mistakenly put our hope in the wrong things. And the result of that is that we run into a chaos which we lift up of our own regard, right? So by our flesh, we have no holiness. This is the same point, right? If we think that we're special because we're just us, we got nothing. And the curses are just amazing. I will make boys their princes. You got to imagine Ahaz is the one that's actually ruling at this point. And the people will oppress one another. Infants shall rule over them. Because like Sodom, they don't even bother to hide their sin. The daughters of Zion are haughty with outstretched necks, glancing wantonly with their eyes, tinkling bracelets on their feet as they prance about. The Lord is going to strike them down with a scab and lay their secret parts bare, taking away their finery, their headbands, their pendants and headdresses and armlets and festal robes. Instead of perfume, they will have rot. Instead of well-set hair, baldness. All of their men shall fall by the sword in battle, so that she shall sit alone on the ground, empty and lamenting and begging every man to walk that walks by. Please, please, I'll pay for my own food. I'll make my own clothes. Just give me your name. Marry me so that I can have somebody to love. I mean, it's terrifying. It's a horrific curse. It is the curse of the fall. It is exactly what we've talked about, the Great Tribulation, right? Summarized here in the diaspora and hinted at with the Babylonian exile. But then it just all turns. The law turns on a head and becomes gospel proclamation in that day. The branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious. Now, don't miss the word branch, right? The sprout, the shoot coming up from the stump of Jesse. In that day, the branch, my righteous servant, the branch shall be glorious. The fruit of the land shall be the pride and honor of the survivors, the remnant. And he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called, don't miss it, holy. Everyone who has been recorded for the life of Jerusalem. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and cleansed the bloodstains of Jerusalem from its midst by a spirit of judgment and a spirit of burning. Is that a baptism of fire and water? Look at that. Then the Lord will create over the whole site of Mount Zion and over all her assemblies a cloud by day and smoke and shining of flame and fire by night, for over all the glory there will be a canopy. Now imagine this, that over the mountain of Zion, which is currently being neglected, God himself will dwell and spread himself, his fire and flame, that puts us back to, you know, Moses, the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire, day and night, all this, right? But where was it before? It was hovering over the Ark of the Covenant. It's going to be back again now as a canopy, as a protection over the whole site of Zion. When? Day and night. There will be a booth for shade by day from the heat and for a refuge and a shelter from the storm and the rain. I mean, he will shelter them with his presence. Now, did you notice the link between all of this so far? The link that goes all the way back to Korah. What did Korah want? To be holy. What does it mean to be holy? It means to be closer to, in proximity to God. What are those made white in the blood of the Lamb promised they are going to be? As they are before the throne of God, right at the gate of his temple, day and night, never ending, sheltered by his very proximity, his presence. They are holy. They are blessed who dwell in his house, ever singing his praise, going from strength to strength to appear before God in Zion, who hears their prayers. Behold, our God is a shield in the face of his anointed, a sun and a shield, favor and honor. No good does he withhold from those who walk uprightly. No good does he withhold from those who stand in his gates. No good does he withhold from the sons of Korah, who are freed from every other service so that they might be on duty day and night. No good does he withhold from you, who with them are brought out of the great tribulation. Sing a new song to the Lord? I say, Let's sing an old one.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes. And check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.